You're listening to The Body's podcast coverage of IAS 2009, the 5th International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Pathogenesis, Treatment, and Prevention. The conference took place in Cape Town, South Africa, from July 19th through July 22nd, 2009.
This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of TheBody.com. Welcome to our coverage of the 5th International AIDS Society Conference on HIV Pathogenesis Treatment and Prevention, known as IAS 2009, which was held in July in Cape Town, South Africa. Although this conference focused mostly on developing world concerns, there was a fair amount of general research that was of interest. I know after an HIV research meeting, I always like to get the activist's take on the research. And so I was pleased when two well-known U.S. HIV-AIDS activists agreed to do an interview. Robert Monk has been involved in HIV-AIDS activism since 1987, the year he tested positive. Since then, he has worked in different positions in the HIV community. In 1997, he founded and continues to coordinate the AIDS InfoNet, a patient education resource. He also participates on numerous advisory boards and international scientific conference planning committees. Also with me today is Matt Sharp, who, like Bob, has spent many years advocating for people with HIV. He has a 10-year history of writing about HIV/AIDS and was education director at Test Positive Aware Network in Chicago before his current job at Project Inform in San Francisco, where he is now director of treatment and education. Both of them attended the conference and agreed to provide some highlights from the meeting. Welcome, Bob and Matt.
Bob, let's start with you. Before we begin going over this particular HIV meeting, I wanted to ask you a question. I know you've been going to these conferences for a long time. Are you feeling more optimistic or more pessimistic about the latest research? Do you think that HIV researchers are really answering the critical questions that most people with HIV are dealing with and want to know the answers to?
I'd have to say that the high point was really the Vancouver International AIDS Conference, where there was the exciting introduction of triple therapy and protease inhibitors. That was the great big ray of hope, which hasn't quite panned out as much as people hoped, but that was a huge high point. Ever since then, I think the results in terms of the developed world have been a lot more incremental. The more recent developments that I think are exciting have to do with the development of the integrase inhibitors, which as a class I think are very exciting. But there's more coming out about complications, which obviously are not very exciting.
And Matt, what about you?
I think one of the things that you always recognize at a meeting when you're hearing a presentation or when you're reading an abstract, it almost always ends up with more research is needed. Though there's been a lot of progress, especially in treatment, as Bob said, in the developed world, there's still a lot of issues with complications. I think in general, the conferences provide a lot of good information, but it's never something, as I've learned over the years, that you get a big breakthrough like the Vancouver meeting. It's very incremental progress. In Cape Town, I found that it was really fascinating to see the disparity between the North and South, the developing countries and the underdeveloped countries. I think people that attended Cape Town, it was probably a really exciting moment for them to have a major international conference there with the majority of the presentations focused on issues in the developing world, operations, research, and so forth.
Do you think by holding such an international meeting in South Africa, more people will be moved by the tragedy for South Africans? I think only 30% of the people who need HIV treatment actually have access. How was it being there when you know that to be true?
If I can just speak up here, I went to a opening night march where I was incredibly moved by attending a march full of people who were activists, African activists. And there I was standing in a crowd of African people, and I was one white gay man in a crowd of many. I'm sure there were other white men there. It was a huge mob of people. But it really was motivational, and it moved me and made me remember the days when we were here in the States in those same kind of rallies and demonstrations. But there I was in Africa this many years later and people are clamoring, demanding, begging for treatments that we've had for years here in the U.S. and in Europe?
I'm very encouraged by the response of international foundations and donors to the issue of treatment in sub-Saharan Africa and in the developing world. I think it's a truly phenomenal response. Major players like the Gates Foundation and the Clinton Foundation and the PEPFAR program are really unprecedented, I think, globally in terms of fighting a pandemic. What I think is sometimes problematic is taking the developed world perspective to the developing world. For example, the DART trial was reported in Cape Town. This was a trial of results of clinical outcomes when the results of viral load and CD4 testing was available to the clinicians, or whether treatment change decisions had to be made solely on clinical outcome. This is a large study, over 3,000 patients. One of the important things it showed is that good clinical research can be done in the developing world. But the outcome of the study was that the clinical results were virtually identical, whether or not the results of viral load and CD4 testing were available. I think that's an incredibly important finding because I think researchers from the North would really almost consider that study to be unethical. Like, how could you even think of not providing viral load and CD4 results? But the reality on the ground was that the results in terms of the patient outcomes were not significantly different. For me, that raises a very critical long-term question, which is, if we do shake loose more money for the developing world, do we want to put it into developing CD4 and viral load capabilities, or simply in purchasing more antiviral medication so that we can get above that 30% figure mentioned?
What concerns me about that as well is here in the U.S. where funding is being cut, especially here in California, where we've just had a major cut by our governor, a line item veto on therapeutic monitoring, for instance. What I'm worried about is people will extrapolate that DART study to what we have here already.
But does this mean that somebody listening to this in the West can go without their CD4 and viral load count monitoring every 3 months and be okay?
No, because I think that's the standard now here in the West.
We cannot simply apply the developed world model of care to the developing world. It's unaffordable. On the other hand, I think that some of the medication choices we do want to apply. I think that the continued use of stabudine, D4T, in the developing world is borderline criminal.
A lot of listeners don't realize that drugs that are no longer used in the West because they are considered toxic and because we have better options are used instead in resource-poor countries. There were a bunch of studies presented in Cape Town that showed that people in Africa are now experiencing facial wasting and body wasting because they're on D4T. But we knew that would happen going in. We just didn't do anything about it because otherwise they would have no access to treatment.
Exactly.
And it was interesting. Pedro Kahn gave a really good talk, a sort of an overview talk about the different standards. And in the middle of his speech said, say no to D4T. I never really heard that at a conference, a doctor or a researcher picking out one specific drug. He was referring to the developing world, but it was really, really good to hear, and he got applause.
But is it the problem that the funders are okaying D4T? It's a complicated patent issue.
It is.
But don't you think HIV-positive people who live in the South or in poor neighborhoods in the United States can relate to their counterparts in the developing world? I mean, people with HIV in many rural areas of the U.S. often don't have access to transportation. In some states, a lot of the drugs they need to help them deal with the side effects of HIV or HIV medications are not covered by public insurance. We have big issues here as well.
Yes, we do, and it's important to remember that. At the same time, I think when you go to a conference in the developing world, you're face-to-face that it's an order of magnitude different. We're talking to people in some of these developing countries who have to walk miles to get to a clinic to get their medications. However, you bring up a very, very good point, which is that there are parts of the United States where the rates of infection are similar to sub-Saharan Africa. There are parts of the U.S. where access to care is a major issue. We need to be more aware of those and responsive to those disparities.
Okay. I have a list of the most interesting research from IAS 2009 that I want to discuss with you both. Let's start with PrEP. From what I could tell, based on the conference program, it seems as if PrEP is coming of age. And for people who may not know what PrEP, P-R-E-P, stands for, it's pre-exposure prophylaxis, or in plain English, HIV treatment to prevent HIV. And what it entails is taking an antiretroviral pill sometime before a possible HIV risk. What do you think about it, Matt?
One of my major focuses of my work here at Project Inform is PrEP and treatment as prevention, or treatment for prevention. I'm encouraged. I'm sitting on the fence regarding whether it's going to ever be effectively rolled out. I think it's out the barn door, so to speak, in terms of the research. There's 9 clinical trials ongoing or planned right now around the world to see if PrEP is going to be effective. But there remains a huge amount of concern and information that we do not have yet about how it's going to be rolled out, how it's going to be paid for. Obviously, the thought of taking a pill to prevent HIV is a very exciting prospect in one way, but there are other negative aspects that still haven't been discovered or still may be discovered. It's just a matter of time, I think, before there'll be some type of PrEP program available, at least in places that can afford to pay for it.
I hear that some savvy doctors are already using it for negative partners of positive men. Do you hear that as well in San Francisco?
I hear it. When you have a sophisticated, privileged population that's able to afford it, I think that probably there are people that are getting it prescribed.
This is usually Truvada or just Viread?
Truvada mostly, yes.
You just take a pill before you take a risk?
Right. The studies span everything from taking it on a daily basis to taking it intermittently to taking it at the time of exposure or prior to exposure, because the half-life of the medication is long enough that it's assumed that it would protect against an exposure. There's several different ways that they're looking at it. Obviously, the intermittent studies would end up being cheaper. We still don't know, but it's being used in different ways.
Let's discuss the issue of when someone who is newly infected with HIV should start HIV treatment. Do you think that we're getting closer to universal treatment, meaning when someone walks into a clinic, no matter what his or her CD4 count is, treatment should be initiated? Does this conference bring us any closer to this?
I think the data simply keep piling up on the side of treat earlier. We're going to keep coming back to this issue of cost and what are the resources available to provide the antiviral treatment. If the resources are there, as I say, I think there's more and more evidence that treating earlier is better.
You can't forget, we don't know what the long-term implications of taking medications are for a lifetime, and we have limited data. If people start taking drugs earlier in the disease course, what's that going to mean in terms of long-term side effects and adverse events? There's one trial that's going to be starting. It's called, or it has started, it's called the START study. It's a huge study that they're going to be looking to see if 500 CD4 starting has a benefit. But it's still 5 years away, and recruitment's going to be a challenge. And there's a lot of disagreement in the research community whether the resources spent on this study are something that should have happened, and maybe they could have gone to other places.
I saw a webcast of Wafa El Sadr discussing immune activation. She talked about something that many researchers have been discussing because of the results of the SMART study. And this is that the early years after someone is just infected with HIV may not be as uneventful as we previously thought, that there are processes going on that are really damaging to one's body, that's the period we've called latency, I believe. any of you have a way to explain it to people who may not really understand the whole process?
I think people still do not understand that period. We're used to charting the progress of HIV infection in terms of viral load, in terms of CD4 count, and in terms of the development of classic opportunistic infections. What we're learning as time goes on is that there are other things happening in the body, specifically the hyperimmune activation. Your immune system is on high alert, and it's revving all the time, and that's not good, is what we're finding out, for that to continue for years. There are inflammatory processes, which is part of the way the body fights an infection, is inflammation. Over years, the negative effects of inflammation add up, and so we're seeing higher rates of heart disease, higher rates of bone loss, higher rates of cancers that are not typically associated or definitive of HIV or AIDS. As time goes on, we're kind of accumulating more and more of this side effect data, but we still don't really know what's going on during the so-called latency period, except that we know that it's not latent.
This is only going on with somebody who's not being treated.
No. This is going on with people on antiviral treatment as well, because our treatments, again, they're aimed at viral load, they're aimed at CD4, and we haven't thoroughly studied, and we certainly do not thoroughly understand these inflammatory processes.
We have a limited viral load assay which counts viral levels to a certain level. What we understand and what we know now is that there's ongoing viral replication that's occurring when latent cells are activated. And so when those cells become activated, there's virus that's churning out, and so there's an immune system reaction to those viruses. One thing that I was really excited about in Cape Town was new and ongoing research in trying to unlock those mechanisms of activating the latent T cell so that there's a method to sort of purge the rest of the virus that's being produced by those latent cells. And that is what's considered a functional cure, which is a stretch, but we don't know yet. We're not there yet. Obviously, there's a lot of research to do. It's in its early stages. But this whole idea about this latency period and activation of those latent cells is an exciting new area. I was really glad to see that they spent quite a bit of time at Cape Town on those two areas.
Is there a way to monitor this?
As Matt said, more study is needed. The SMART study, which produced pretty dramatic results, has provided an incredible service to researchers by creating a huge library of samples from the people in that study. The real value of these samples is that we know the clinical outcomes of the people who gave those samples. These are going to be used for a series of biomarker studies, and the first of those are just starting to appear. People are throwing out things like C-reactive protein, IL-6, D-dimer, and the first studies are just starting to come out suggesting which of these have the strongest links to clinical outcome. I think there's going to be a lot of research coming out over the next several years from the INSIGHT Study Network, which is an international network funded partly by the U.S. government. I'm very excited to see what comes out of that.
But a lot of people don't want to wait until they find out whether it works or not. Are you guys getting IL-6 and D-dimer level looked at all the time?
No, I think it's the thing of not really knowing enough at this point. Sure, you can go get those tests, and okay, so lower D-dimer levels are better than higher D-dimer levels. So what? What do you do with that? Are we going to look for a therapy to lower D-dimer levels, or are we going to wait until we understand the inflammatory mechanism and try to affect that? Look what happened with T-cell counts. Everybody was all excited about interleukin-2 boosting CD4 counts. There's no question that you can boost your CD4 counts. But the studies that were just now definitively reported show that the CD4 increases from taking IL-2 are not as functional as the CD4 increases from antiretroviral therapy. I have a crude analogy, which is it's like putting a bunch of ice cubes in your mouth and then taking your temperature, and lo and behold, your temperature is lower. So what? I think people are looking into, for example, the increases in CD4 counts that we're starting to see with some of the integrase inhibitors, and trying to understand if those increases in CD4 counts are linked to better clinical outcomes.
There's a lot of people out there who can't get their CD4 counts to budge, and they're desperately looking for something.
And that is a major focus, and I think as a result of the IL-2 studies, people are going to be a lot more cautious about interpreting an increase in CD4 counts. They're going to really look for clinical correlates, clinical outcomes, before they say, hurrah, we raised the CD4 count by 60 cells. We need to know what that means.
And Margolis is doing work with this drug class called HDAC inhibitors. The studies that he's done so far look at a way to activate latent T cells so that the virus can be produced, and then hopefully the antiviral therapies that are in use will work to kill virus. So far, the HDAC inhibitors have not proven to work, but there are some others that have not been tried yet, so they may be safer and they may be a better way to unlock that virus. That's that area of research I was talking about that's really exciting.
On to some HIV therapy trials. What about the Prezista monotherapy trial? There used to be so many about Kaletra monotherapy. Do you think it's ready for prime time?
No, but I think what is ready for prime time is breaking the idea of protease inhibitor plus 2-nuc. That was kind of like the dogma. I think that's pretty much shattered, partly by the introduction of integrase inhibitors, partly by the results of some of these trials using innovative combinations, innovative compared to the dogma, and a lot of them are working quite well.
Yeah, the Prezista monotherapy studies, what interested me about that was that there was actually two studies presented which had similar results. When you see two pretty large studies like this that have similar results, it's impressive.
But whenever I ask the docs, they say, oh, well, yeah, but I wouldn't do it. I mean, is anybody doing it? I mean, what's the point of all these trials if no one wants to do it?
I think there's always a fear in breaking away from whatever the dogma happens to be. Certainly from my experience living in San Francisco in the early years of HIV, patients drive a lot of the treatment models. And if enough patients come up and say, doc, I'm going to do it, or guess what, doc, I didn't take my nukes this month and my viral load is still controlled, I think it's going to happen insidiously.
The other thing that concerns me about those two studies I was referring to, they're both open-label studies. We still don't have real good, hard data to show that it works. The Kaletra monotherapy studies was all the buzz for a while. It turned out that they're small studies. There's still not been a larger study to show that that's an effective strategy. I think it's too early to definitively say that it's going to work anyway, but there will be people, like Bob said, that will ask their doctors because they've heard about it and they'll want to do it.
Anyway, on to Cellzentry. Poor Cellzentry. Trying to find a place in the universe.
It was a reanalysis of their 96-week data, and it came out to have a little slightly better outcome than the original analysis. To me, what's a little more exciting is the development of a genotype for a CCR5, which may end up replacing the tropism assay, which is extremely expensive and takes about 3 weeks to turn around. But I think for those people who have CCR5 tropic virus, this might be exciting news, both the merit reanalysis and the new genotype.
And the genotype would be available everywhere? Could you tell us a little bit about that test?
Yeah, it's basically already provided. I mean, it's already in the standard genotype analysis. And then they run an extra phenotype. It's called genotype 2 phenotype.
Those are the common resistance tests.
That's right. They have a separate additional analysis on top of it. I'm not a scientist, so I can't go into the details of it, but it looks promising. We've been trying to figure out ways to encourage companies to look for other ways to find out tropism. They all have their problems. They're all expensive. If there would be a genotype test, that would open up the door, I think, for more use of cells entry.
Well, that should be, I think, very hopeful.
Stay tuned, I think, because it's not there yet. But again, you know, we have to wait a little bit longer. But this was the first I've seen of this new genotype.
On to photo, which is, again, Bob, not in the dogma. Take treatment 5 days and take the weekend and don't get treated.
I've heard it referred to as the Provincetown party plan.
I mean, it's a cute trial, but is it workable in the real world? Is anyone going to try it?
Yes, I think people are trying it. I think that this is a perfect example of what I was talking about, that patients will try something, and as long as there are published results, which there are in this case, that say, hey, this could really work, when you dig into the pharmacokinetics and how much drug stays in your bloodstream and can you take the weekend off and not worry about taking your meds, I think people will be doing it.
Could you explain why the particular meds that were used in the photo study are the critical piece to understanding the success of this trial? We don't want people on a different regimen to think they could take off for the weekend because of the photo trial.
Right. That is certainly not the case. The drugs in photo, which include Sestiva, that has a very long half-life. It stays in your system for a very long time. In fact, I remember when the drug was being developed that some people said that it might have been approvable as an every other day drug, but then that would have been a nightmare because who's going to remember which day they take it and which day they don't? However, that means that if you don't take it for a day, there's probably still enough in your system to fight HIV. And then when you hit it hard again on Monday, again, apparently, and this is a fairly small study still, but the results have been fairly consistently positive.
I think it's hopeful for people who are tired of taking pills. It's not a real treatment interruption study, per se, because you still have the blood levels in your body. But it's a treatment interruption study in terms of the physical aspect of taking the meds, so that's a good thing. I was encouraged to see it because there's been sort of a quash on doing any more treatment interruption studies. I think that if the trial is designed right and if it's the right medication that stays in the bloodstream longer, then I think that these kind of studies are possible, and who knows what will happen after we get more information in larger studies.
I see this as part of a larger trend, which includes the number of studies on monotherapy or induction maintenance, got a really bad name, where you would start with a standard regimen and then back off. But now there are options being looked at, and I think we have to with people living longer. If people are taking medications for 15, 20, 25 years, it makes a big difference whether you're taking pills twice a day or once a day, three pills a day or twice, two pills. So I'm really glad to see it all.
I'm wondering, for the photo study, it's not just the convenience of taking the weekend off. Is it also preserving your body?
I think it's really kind of foolhardy to make that assumption after the SMART study. The SMART study, the basic premise was if we take people off of meds when their CD4 counts climb, they will have fewer side effects versus taking antiretrovirals continuously. The study very definitively said that's not the case. Of course, in the SMART study, you had viral load increases because people went off of the medications for sometimes weeks or months, and the viral load increased, and they had more problems, not less. But I still think it would be a mistake to extrapolate to the photo study and say, oh, you're taking less drugs, you'll have less side effects.
I noticed there was very little about cancer and HIV. And is there any new understanding about why people are getting head or neck or anal cancers?
Brian Gazzard gave a talk. I heard about it. I didn't attend it, but it did relate to some of the possible mechanisms around cancers that are caused by viruses that may be implicated in people who are aging, and specifically talking about papillomavirus, the cause of some of the head and neck and throat cancers. So those are on the increase, and that may be because of the immune response in older people, but also because of ongoing HPV.
Vitamin D deficiency was more likely if you were taking Sustiva, which was sort of unknown before.
Yeah, and I think that this is an interesting avenue of research because it's so simple to remedy vitamin D deficiency. To look at HIV patients and say, take a good supplement without overdoing it, a little time in the sun, and we'll see what happens.
And then you go in the sun, Bob, and you get skin cancer. It's a big circle. It's an endless circle.
Yes, it is.
I mean, one of the things that I wanted to say about aging and HIV is specifically I want to talk about diet, nutrition, and smoking. I think if people would really focus on looking at ways to improve their diet, stop smoking, then I think that may have a big impact.
And not worry so much about all this data about aging and HIV.
Well, because it's still coming out and there's still a lot to understand about the processes around aging. A lot of the effects of HIV are strongly related to the effects of aging, so it's sort of this double-edged sword that's occurring, and that there may not be much we can do about it. I'm thinking that really concentrating and focusing on holistic health and things like stopping smoking, eating better, well, as they do in people who are not positive, definitely would have an impact on your overall health.
It really would. Unfortunately, we've grown up in an era where we look for the magic bullet. We've gotten magic bullets to reduce or control viral load and to increase CD4 counts. There is no magic bullet for stopping smoking. Yet, it shows up again and again and again as a major health risk factor. So to be able to address that issue, to be able to address physical exercise, to be able to address the kind of diet and lifestyle issues would probably have more impact than waiting for 5 or 10 years till some of this research bears fruit and then maybe adding another pharmaceutical product to your regimen.
Don't you think not enough physicians are discussing these kind of issues? Maybe they don't, no one has time, and certainly, but to say that it's a holistic thing, that you, it's not just HIV, but you have to take care of yourself and exercise and do all this other stuff.
I think that's gaining traction among physicians, but it's very frustrating because what do you do? Like Matt says, people have been trying to stop smoking for decades, and to use the scare tactic of, well, it's going to increase your risk of a heart attack and it's going to increase your risk of bone fractures. How far does that go? Not very.
I think there's more and more physicians who are, at least here in the Bay Area, a lot of the doctors here have been around a long time, and they have aging populations of patients. I am seeing and talking to physicians who are more interested in a holistic approach, and they're trying to implement ways of caring for their patients that way. So I do see a lot of it, more of it here, and if that's happening in other places, I'm not sure.
Is that happening in AIDS organizations as well? Are they doing wellness workshop?
Yes. Well, again, here in the Bay Area, you see more of it. I think it probably in the urban centers, you are seeing more of it.
This has been great. Thank you so much for talking with me and giving your take on Cape Town.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebody.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from IAS 2009. For more coverage of this conference, please visit us online at thebody.com/IAS2009.